Hello, everybody. This is Art Sippo.
And Rick Croxton.
And you are now entering the Book Cave. This evening, we have very special guests on. We have Chris Paul Carey. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
And we have Mike Croteau. Hey, Mike.
Hello, Art.
Okay. Chris, of course, is the author of the new novel, Song of Kwasan, which is based upon the notes by Phil Farmer. And in fact, this is actually a collaboration between Chris and Phil Farmer before Phil Farmer had passed. This particular novel is the third one in a series that Phil had started back in the late 1970s.
Early 1974, according to this one book.
Okay. Yeah, it was the early, he wrote them in the early 70s, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Release, is it that long?
Yeah, I have a copy of the doll, Hayden of Ancient Hope Park, and I'm going to look here on the copyright.
Yeah, that just makes me feel older, guys.
Yeah. Now, the first one's 1974 when it was printed.
Yeah. That is correct, yep.
Wow. So this has been a long time in coming. This was a series that I really enjoyed, and now we're getting the opportunity to actually have the final story that Phil had envisioned for the series. This was part of the legacy that came from the Magic Filing Cabinet. And Mike, I understand you were the one who actually discovered the notes for this story.
Yes, I did. Back when we were producing Farmer File, the quarterly magazine we did with every issue having something by Phil in it that nobody had ever read before, I found the folder. I can't remember exactly what it said on the tab, but I immediately knew what it was, and I looked at it, and, my heart skipped a beat because doing Phil's website, I get emails from people all the time saying, hey, maybe I missed it. Did Phil ever write the next book in this series or that series? And, people for years have been clamoring for another World of Tears. Very many people cannot believe that there isn't a sequel to The Stone God Awakens. But right up there was, how many Opar books did he write? What comes after Flight to Opar? I need to get that next book. And, of course, Phil stopped it, too. So as soon as I saw the folder, I thought, my first thought was Chris Carey, because I knew if anybody in the world knew as much about the Opar books and about the background of them, the inspiration for Phil, it was Chris Carey. I'm sure he knew at the time. Phil knew the most, and Chris was second in line. So, and I can't remember who I contacted first, Chris or Phil, but both of them seem pretty happy with the idea of Chris possibly finishing that third book.
Wonderful. You know, this book actually fits into not just the series that Phil had been doing, but these three books, but it also has connections to other things in his oeuvre, including the Walt Newton Universe and Time's Last Gift. But also Phil put in other material from other authors as well. Can you elaborate a little on that? Because that's part of the appeal, I think, of the series.
Is this addressed to me?
Either one of you. You guys are the experts. You go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Well, the series, of course, was originally inspired by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Opar was a lost city from the Tarzan novels. And what Phil did was he posited what this city would have been like long, long ago at the close of the last ice age, about 12,000 years ago. And he basically created his whole own world out of it, Phil did. He did an immense amount of world building. He created a language for the culture, the Kokarsan culture, a syllabary, a calendar, maps, you name it. So it was in a large part inspired by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Phil actually got the kernel of the idea from two Burroughs fans, Breckel and Harwood, who had written an unpublished monograph theorizing what this mother civilization would have been like, which they called Atlantis, and positioned actually in an inland sea in Africa. So this kind of titillated Phil's imagination, and he just went off with it, and he wrote the first two books. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, also, he had, he got some themes in there from H. Rider Haggard too, didn't he? And
that is true. The series, the trilogy, can actually be seen as a continuation of the book Alan and the Ice Gods by H. Rider Haggard. Two characters from that novel by Haggard show up as characters with slightly differently spelled names in the Opar books. And this would be Lalila, who becomes Hadon's love interest. I may be pronouncing some of these names strangely, and it's because I'm trying to follow Phil's pronunciation guidelines. Lalila becomes the hero Hadon's love interest, and then there's the manling Paga, who is actually called Pog in the Haggard novels, but according to the way that Co-Carsons speak, they couldn't end a syllable with a G, with a hard G sound, so they had to say Paga.
Ah.
So he is the one who introduces the what Haggard called the Axe of Victory into the series. He brought this into the series and passed it on to the hero of the book, which I completed, Kwasin. So, and that the axe plays quite an important role in the series, especially as the books go on.
I got a question. Is you reprinted all the first two books again, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, is there anything new from, say, like my doll copies to DAW copies to what's out right now?
The book, I should say, is Gods of Opar, Tales of Lost Co-Carsa, and it includes the three novels of the series, Hadon of Ancient Opar, Flight to Opar, and then the third novel, which is new, has never been seen before, never been published before, The Song of Kwasin. And that is an entirely new material. The other two books are straight reprints, right? They're the same ones you read in the Daw editions.
I just kind of wonder, because I've known some people, they say, hey, this here was cut out from this one publisher.
And No, we weren't able to find. I was actually looking for the original manuscripts, but they have probably gone off to a collector or something. Phil and his wife Betty sold off a lot of his manuscripts over the years, just to make a little side money or what have you. And so we were not able to locate the original manuscripts. We did find some pieces, like for instance, we found an alternate chronology, which really was kind of useless. It was apparently an early draft. It doesn't really sync up with the book. But there are, in the limited edition, published by Subterranean Press, you get a bonus chapbook, and that will contain extra material in it, a lot of stuff right from Phil's files. If you want to read the original outline that Phil wrote that the third book is based on, that's going to be in the chat book. You also have a really impressive essay article on the Co-Carson language, which goes into some heavy-duty linguistics and anthropology behind the Co-Carson language. And then we have a Co-Carson glossary, which is the actual terms from the Co-Carson language. There's a Co-Carson calendar that he has developed. And then there's a brief article called The Plants of Kokarsa that goes into the ecology of ancient Africa and what the civilization cultivated and had access to due to the intervention of the archer god Sahindar, who mysteriously appears before the series begins and essentially founds the civilization, gives them the tools with which they can build up a civilization and pass over the old Stone Age directly into the Bronze Age. And that's it's a kind of complicated storyline that mm-hmm. actually begins in Phil's novel Time's Last Gift, whereby there is a time traveler who comes back in time and eventually becomes a god in the Kokarsan civilization. And this is the individual I was talking about who gave them a great many boons that allowed them to launch their civilization.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Now, Phil really did an awful lot of work on this. I know in Time's Last Gift, which, as you say, you know, really talks about events that happened probably about 2,000 years before what we're going to see in our story.
Yes.
The story you wrote. He talks about the source of the Indo-European language, and he actually gives a theory as to how the Indo-European language developed, which was very interesting. It was his own little theory, and he did some studies in linguistics, as I recall, didn't he?
Yes, he did all the way. He did most of a master's degree, is my understanding. In one interview, he states that. So he had quite an extensive background in linguistics, and if you look through his notes, it's very, very obvious that he did. I had to compile the language essay from about five different drafts of the same article where he was working out the language, and wow, did he do some heavy duty thinking on this. It was quite a feat to order it together so that it made sense, because there was not an actual final draft. There was one that was very close, but then there were certain elements that were left out that had to be combined from the previous drafts. But I think it turned out quite well. I worked with an editor. I worked for Paizo Publishing. We published the Pathfinder role-playing game, and there's an editor there, Judy Bauer, who has a master's degree in linguistics, and I was able to have her go over the article and point out some inconsistencies and things like that. So I think we're pretty good with pretty close to how Phil would have published the final article.
You know, it's worth noting at this point that Phil mentions in there the discovery of a berry, a plant berry that is several times sweeter than sugar. And this was back in 1974, I think he mentions it in the book. And that actually is the basis for aspartame, the artificial sweetener.
Yes, yeah. And the Kokarsan name for it was Moomath. Yes.
So Phil actually, that was a new discovery. He put it in. And it was around that time it was actually before they started marketing aspartame, so he had kind of predicted that coming down the pipe. It's very, it's very, very typical, of Phil to have been a little bit ahead of his time on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he saw an article in Signature magazine, and it just jumped out at him, probably as a science fiction writer, as something that he wanted to put into the world building. And there's all sorts of stuff like that in his world building for this series.
You know, there's also something that in here that is something near and dear to Phil's heart, because he echoes it in several other of his stories. And that is the idea of an original mother goddess religion.
Yes.
You know, with a, you know, where the feminine is of ascendance and the males assume a secondary role. You know, you see that in A Night of Light, and you see it in some of Phil's other stories where this is something important to him. I think he probably was influenced somewhat by, there's a Montague Summers who postulated about this, that the, you know, the early goddess religion had predated the more, masculine religions. And, you know, that's an interesting storyline that he puts in there following, this kind of mythology. So this novel, among other things, is somewhat typical, I think, of some of Phil's work, because it hooks up a lot of mythic ideas. It hooks up, we eventually get into a little Walt Newton-y stuff too, which we can talk about as well. And some of the themes that he collects in his other work.
Yeah, I think he was also influenced by Robert Graves in his monumental work, The White Goddess. And yeah, he wrote stories like, what was the one, Mother Earth Wants You, I believe it was called. And, of course, there are a lot of fertility themes in the novel Flesh. Yeah.
So these are, you know, it's very interesting that he melds all this stuff together so well. Well, now, go ahead.
He was a true Renaissance man. I mean, yeah. you just don't find him like that anymore. He could combine everything. He was very much took an anthropological approach, and I also have an anthropology degree. I have a bachelor's in anthropology, and so it's a field where you can combine things from all different directions. You know, all the sciences are involved, and also a lot of the softer humanities can be involved. So I think that really appealed to him, just with that personality that he had, that was just wanted to devour all knowledge and somehow synthesize it. You know.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. He tried very hard, I think, to make sense of things. And he had a vision for the world and for reality, which I think comes across throughout his oeuvre over and over again. We see elements of it coming out.
I'm sorry, of
his work, you know, parts of his work, of his total work, elements of it keep coming out. You know, the idea of the mother goddess myth. You have the various hero myths. His vision of what it is to be a hero. You know, he has very strong characters, and he has characters that are, how should I put it? They're somewhat unconventional, in their, you know, the Hadon, I think is typical of that. Someone who's somewhat unconventional, even, and it's Kwasin, that's how you pronounce it?
Yes, yep.
Kwasin. Even Kwasin is kind of an unconventional character, because he is, at one and the same time, he's rather a freebooter, but he also has a rather a degree of piety, which is interesting for someone who is basically a freebooter.
Yeah, well, I think just speaking broadly about Phil's characters, he wanted them to be realistic heroes. You know, I think he took the kind of the mold of the, you know, Egrés Burroughs type pulp hero, and then added a realistic dimension to them. So some readers found of the more traditional pulp stories and things like that found Hadon to be too violent sometimes, you know, because he or too perhaps cynical or what's the word? I'm blanking on the word. But he made decisions based on what needed to be done, not based on following a romantic storyline. You know, if this character were really thrown into these situations, how would he react? Would he react, you know, to survive, would he do anything to survive, or would he not, you know? and I feel like he, in a way, Phil was doing a very, he was taking the pulps and making them realistic.
Yes.
And yet keeping this, the epic sense of adventure along the way and making something new for our modern age.
You know, the thing that always struck me with Phil is his, he always has his heroes, you know, realizing that they have to take responsibility for what they're doing. And,
right.
He does not allow them to pass off responsibility to gods or kings or queens. You know, they basically have got to stand up for themselves and do what they feel has to be, as you say, had to be done in a particular time and in a particular place. And that's a theme that goes throughout all of his work. It's very important to him. You know, cause as you well know, anybody who's read Phil or knew Phil, he was a bit of an iconoclast during much of his life. A lot of his work pushed the boundaries. And, that's because he felt a call to do it that way. And by gosh, he was going to do things his own way. He was going to talk about things that other people wouldn't talk about, even though they were interested in it and wanted to talk about it.
Right.
That's how he got off into a lot of themes on sexuality and on the depth psychology of sexuality. His stories are never superficial.
Right.
As you said, there's always an amount of depth here, and there's a lot of thought that goes into it. Well, now the Kwasin character was a relatively minor character up until this advent. Up until that time, most of the action in the Kokarsin stories had focused on Hadan.
Yes. So in the first novel, he comes on the scene. He has been exiled. And living out in the wild lands because he ravished a priestess. And, when Hadan goes out into his adventures and goes out into the wild lands, he runs into his cousin, Kwasin, and brings him back with him to the civilization. And so he's kind of a foil for Hadan in a sense. They don't exactly get along. They were both raised together in a cave, outside of Opar by their uncle. The uncle favored Hadan but what's interesting is that in the first book, you know, the first two books, you get Hadan's point of view. And so Kwasin is portrayed as this, pretty much this braggart and brute. Who antagonizes Hadan to a large extent, and yet he's in some way a very attractive character, even though he does horrible things. you're just want to read more about him, I think. And I've actually heard some readers say that he overshadowed Hadan in the first book because he was such an interesting character. Now, when you get to the third book, you get it from Kwasin's point of view, and you see that there are reasons, perhaps, why he does not get along with Hadan. There's jealousy going on. There was the favoritism by his uncle, and you get the feel a little bit for Kwasin. He's very, very much an anti-hero in many ways. And while I wouldn't say that he's exactly redeemed, because I think to redeem his character would take something vital away from it.
Right.
He does learn as he goes along, and his character certainly changes by the end. And he is. You were talking earlier about these characters of Phil's who would stand up and do what needed to be done against all social conventions and things like that. Well, this culture that they live in, that Hadan and Kwasin live in, is a very religious one. And the larger storyline is about a civil war between the priestesses who worship the fertility goddess, the mother goddess Ko, and the priests who worship the sun god, Rezu. So a lot of the characters hot on, you know, you start reading the first book and he's very much in awe of Ko, you know, and almost terrified of the mother goddess. But very much a follower of Ko. Kwasin is a little bit different, but he still has that, even Kwasin, this great, you know, self-centered braggart type individual, he still has a fear that's been instilled in him of Ko. You get a little bit more of his storyline with that in a novella, called Kwasin and the Bear God, which sort of tells the story of how he came to fight on the side of the goddess worshippers against the priests.
Yeah, and now that's available in one of the Meteor House books, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Mike, would you like to address that?
Sure. That is available in The Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer 2. And The Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer series is a limited edition. They're numbered books. If you haven't bought them, you can buy the pair of them. They have matching numbers. If you already have Volume 1, we'll send you the same number of Volume 2. And we hope to do, you know, who knows how many, and I have plans for at least 5, hopefully we'll go beyond that. And I was just thinking a minute ago of asking Chris to tell us how he found that storyline and his reaction when he first discovered that folder.
Are you speaking of the novella or the novel?
The novella.
The novella.
Outline.
Okay, the story of the novella is back in January, help me if I get the year wrong because the years are starting to blur together, 2008 or 2009, when did Phil pass away?
2009.
So this was in January 2009. And we had a bunch of Phil's friends and fans went out it was mostly the closer inner circle went out to celebrate Phil's birthday in Peoria. And Phil was in a bad way at that time, but we still, I think it cheered Betty up to see us all out there. But while we were out there, I was waiting for my flight to arrive, but I had a few hours to kill, so my friend Paul Spiteri and I got permission from Betty to go through the files again, and I think it was the very first thing I pulled out was a folder called said Hadon - Ko Carson Lore, and I have no idea how we missed this folder before, but I pulled it out, and that's the folder that had a lot of the bonus material that's going in the chat book. It had all the Phil's more complete language essay in it. I had an earlier draft before, but there's much more material in there. But it also had an alternate outline to the Song of Kwasin, which kind of floored me because I had already finished the book at that point. So I was kind of terrified that, oh no, this is the real outline. It turned out it was a draft of an outline. It was only a partial outline. About half of the book was outlined in it. And it was either similar to the other outline. It corresponded pretty much exactly to the other outline. Or it had elements in it that actually did not work. Things that did not match up with the published books already. The books that were already published. But there was 2 pages of the outline that told the story of right after the first chapter in the Song of Kwasin. And I realized that this could actually be told as a separate story. And by this point, the novel had already been sold to Subterranean and or had gone off to the agent. Can't remember if it had sold quite yet. And so I I took it home. I sorted through a lot of the bonus material, getting it ready for the bonus material that's going to be in the chapbook. And I kind of sat on the outline with the idea that it could have been a story. And then the folks at Meteor House asked me if I would like to position it as kind of a major novella to be published in one of the worlds of Philip Z. Farmer books. And so I took that, and that's how that story was born. I wrote the story based on Phil's outline and a little bit of text by Phil that was relating to there was a little passage that Phil had about a creation myth of the Co-Carsons, and I put that verbatim into the story in the words of one of the priestesses who was speaking in the story.
Hmm. Very interesting. Now, you also had a story in the first volume, didn't you?
I have a story in there in volume one called A Kick in the Side. And this is a story about Hadon's scribe, Hinoki is how you pronounce it in Co-Carson. And I was, when you read Flight to Opar, there comes a point where Hinokli actually literally drops out of the story. And it always struck me as very abrupt, and I always wondered what the hell happened to him, you know? and it just kind of gnawed at me. And I was actually still writing the Song of Kwasin when I wrote that story, and it just kind of came out one night. I didn't even intend to write it, and I just sat down and it came out in a single sitting, which is insane. Wow. I don't write stories in a single sitting normally, but that one just came right out. So you get to see a little bit. He was a very smart character. Perhaps smarter even than Hadon. He's educated in the capital. And I wanted to see what if you put him through as much misery as you could, how he would respond to it, and how he would react as a hero in a quite different way than someone like Hadon might react. Mm-hmm. So I was quite happy with how it turned out.
Yeah. It's interesting because he was, if I remember correctly, he was, as you say, he was the scribe. He was a writer, very much kind of like you are.
Yeah, well, I actually based him in a sense on Phil, because Phil had a lot of, in his long career as a writer, had a lot of run-ins with obstacles in it to his career. Yes. and a lot of characters who pretty much tried to sabotage his career. And so in a way, this was the story of a writer kind of striking back, mm-hmm. at these types who try to sabotage this great writer like Phil. You know, why would anyone do that to him? You know, I think as readers, we just want more and more words from him. Which unfortunately we can't get anymore. I would have loved to have seen Phil finish this book, I will say. I mean, it was a pleasure to write it, to write the Song of Kwasin, but man, I would have loved to have seen Phil write it.
I hear you. Well, you know, I think you did a wonderful job with it. It's a tribute to Phil's original characters. It's a great story. It's a whole lot of fun, and, you know, as I said, I've been waiting for this book to come out for, gosh, 30-some-odd years now. 36 years, I guess it is at this point. And it was really worth the wait. I really enjoyed it very much. And I encourage anybody who is a Phil Farmer fan, or, you know, somebody who enjoys the old sword and sorcery type of story, this is a good one. It's a little bit more of a realistic story. There's not magic involved in it, per se. But there is that little bit of magic of an unknown civilization where, you know, characters are living closer to the land and the heroes are right in there. battling with their own muscles and guts, to bring about a denouement to a story. And it really was a good job. So, you know, I'm happy that you finished the story. I think you did a wonderful job with it. And, that raises a question. Is there any possibility that there might be any other, stories in line? Are there any other little stories that might get stuck into the intricacy, whatever it is? because you've already filled in a couple of those interstices. That's the word,
right?
Yeah, are there any other little stories we might expect to see?
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to hear that you enjoyed the story. I spent a lot of time on it, trying to get it right, and I took a purist approach to it, and I think if you read the outline. And that's going to be in the bonus chapbook, and you look at the novel, you'll see that all of that outline is in there. Mm-hmm. You know, there is one scene that didn't quite fit, and it's in there as well, but not exactly the same way. But and that was due to some internal series things that happened that it couldn't play out exactly the same. But I took a very purist approach to it, and I'm hoping that the fans will like it. Now to your second question. In fact, there is something I'm working on right now. Do you want to announce it, Mike, or should I just go right into it?
Well, before we get there, let me ask you a different question.
Okay.
A slightly different question. Phil, back in the 70s when this series was coming out, had said that he'd like to write 5 or 7 or 9 or 12 Opar books. Is that still the case, or is the Song of Kwasin the conclusion? And if it's the conclusion, is it really the conclusion?
Well, when I spoke to Phil about it, when we were initially talking about me writing the novel, he wanted the third book to be a conclusion. You know, he wanted a trilogy. He wanted this main series to wrap up. But I don't think there's so much more that obviously that he wrote about, that he spoke about in interviews and things like that. I don't think anyone can question the fact that the third book is the conclusion of the trilogy. That said, I think that there obviously could be other stories going beyond that, other novels going beyond that. I have notes down for other novels that are based on Phil's notes. He did leave behind a very brief outline of events, more so of character relationships that were going to continue in the series. Kind of conjoined with some of the events. If you read the story, there's some big events that happen at mm-hmm. the end of the third novel. There's some stuff tied into that and some relationships, based on the characters who go on after those events. And, so I have some ideas about what could, like, I picture that there could be another trilogy. Probably revolving around Hadon's son. It would be a new generation coming along. Mm-hmm. It would probably have Abeth in it. And, Phil spoke in an interview many years ago with, David Pringle, about, that he wanted to write a series. He wanted to continue the series, I should say, with Hadon's son in it. And Hadon's son would go on and set out from his father's city and, for whatever reason, leave it, which I actually know because I've read Phil's notes, and leave it and found his own city. And the city would become known as the City of Kor, which, of course, is the lost city, which is discovered by Alan Quatermain in the book She and Alan, and then chronologically speaking, in the series, is later discovered by Leo Vinci and what's his name, Holly, from the book She by H. Rider Haggard. So I think a whole series could be written about what I call in my head, you know, informally, the foundation of core trilogy that would go on. Mm-hmm. But I would, if someone were to propose that I would write it, I would, you know, I would have to have a deal on the table to write it at this point, because I have so many other projects going on. But that is, it's out there. It's a possibility.
It sounds like there's quite a few stories that can easily be pulled out of the Opar, you know, legends.
There certainly are. There's a whole, as you see, there's a whole chronology. In the original publication, it was at the end of Hadon of Ancient Opar, and in this mm-hmm. the new trilogy, it's in the omnibus. It's the end of the omnibus, telling basically the whole extent of the Kokarsan civilization. So there are a lot of heroes and kings and priestesses and priestess heroines that that go off and do great things.
Now, on the end of Hadon of Ancient Opar, you've got about 20 pages, and it says like major events.
Right, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
You know, you have like all the different years and stuff like that, and it's like, you know, feels really winded up for somebody can just kind of say, hey, I want to take at this period of time and inject a character.
Funny you should say that. Because this is pretty much what Mike and I were alluding to. That's exactly the type of story I'm writing right now. I'm working on a story. This is the first time we're announcing it anywhere. I'm working on a novella, which will be hopefully a lengthy novella, maybe 30,000 words or so. And it's going to be called Exiles of Ko. And it will be set, it'll be a prequel story to the trilogy of novels. It'll be set several hundred years beforehand with the priestess heroine Lupoth. It's spelled like Lupoath. Mm-hmm. It's pronounced Lupoth. If you look on the map of the city of Kokarsa, you'll see down on the south side of the city, there's a Gulf of Lupoth. This is the same priestess heroine that it's named after. And if you recall, or if you will read when you read the omnibus, Hadon, at the end of Flight to Opar, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I will say that a statue of Lupoth plays a very significant role in how Hadon combats his enemies. and so there's kind of references to her throughout the series. In each of the books, there are references to her. And I just found it very intriguing. And so I kind of have pieced together those little tidbits. There was more than when I actually went digging, there was more than I thought there was. So that there was enough that I could kind of get some ideas of what was going on with her and her adventures. So that will be coming out later this year. It's not finished yet.
Right.
I'm writing it right now, so mm-hmm. I don't want to commit to a date, but definitely later this year, perhaps in time for Pulp Fest and FarmerCon in August. That's the goal, but we shall see.
Yeah, now, will that be who's going to be the publisher on that? Do you have a publisher lined up?
That will be published as a single volume, a standalone volume by Meteor House.
Ooh, very good.
So we actually already have the cover art for it by a fantastic artist named Mike Hoffman. I don't know if you're aware of his work. Very iconic, more like the paperback covers you would have seen in the 1960s or 70s on an Edgar Rice Burroughs book or a Robert E. Howard book. Very Frazetta.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wait till you see it. I'm blown away by Mike Hoffman's work.
And for people listening to this, we're actually recording this on Tuesday. It should go live on Thursday. And Friday or Saturday is when we're going to put the cover up on the Meteor House website and announce the book and start taking pre-orders for it. And I mention that because, as Chris said, this is the first time it's been announced anywhere. So Book Cave is getting the, you know, worldwide exclusive. We're talking about it here before the publishing website even announces the book.
Well, fantastic. We got an exclusive. That's wonderful. Thank you.
The story, to a large extent, is going to build off of Phil's larger mythos. Has significant ties to his retelling of J.H. Rosny's Iron Castle.
Yes.
So I think that fans of Phil's, and just in the pulp fans in general, are going to really, really enjoy it. I'm excited as I'm writing it. So.
Yeah. Well, I want to say again, I think you did a terrific job on the Quasine story, and boy, I'm really looking forward to reading that. That sounds like it's going to be fun.
This
whole idea of the Sahindar story in the background, and this wonderful civilization that is. That's a possible civilization that could have been. It really is a lot of fun and very, very clever. And, I enjoyed it. I thought you handled all of the action scenes and all that very, very well. It was a very satisfying story.
Thank you. You mentioned Sahindar. This might excite some folks of the series. Sahindar will actually appear in the novella, the new novella. In a large role.
Okay. Actually, the more I hear about, Phil Farmer and all the work he does in these novels, it's just, the more I'm impressed, and it's like that he's able to write as many books as he did with all the work he's putting into each novel. For the history and, all the background.
Yeah, it is amazing. If you look at his career, he, and Mike might be able to speak better to this than I can, but he worked full time for a long while. He tried to make it as just a writer in the 1950s, and thought he was going to when he won a science fiction novel writing contest whereby he was supposed to get a lot of money and a novel deal, and then the money got embezzled, and it all fell. His career, kind of took it. Well, not his career took a dive, I should say, but his hopes of just being able to write and have that be his career, his sole career, were kind of smashed. And so, if you look at his output, it's really not that great. In the first decade or so of his career, but eventually he was able to set aside he worked as a technical writer for quite a while. He was able to move on and just write. And then you see a pretty tremendous output beginning in the 1970s, I think. And it's pretty amazing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The amount of information that he put into his stories and the thought that he put behind it, it made him a favorite of mine, way back in the day. So there were some of us who actually were around in the 1970s.
I was around.
I was kind of young.
Well, I'll tell you what, there are fewer and fewer of us these days.
I saw At Pierce Core in the theater. So.
But yeah, I mean, I always looked at the 1970s. Phil was the writer. He was the one I was always looking for. Every new book that he came out with, I grabbed immediately. Those were the days. And I was when he started to do this, when he went through his pulp period, where he was doing the biographies, and he was doing The Feast Unknown and the other Empire of the Nine stories. It was just marvelous. There's never be a time like that again.
I got in, to speak truthfully, I got into Phil in the early 1980s, and he was still writing then, and just the thought of a new Philip Zay Farmer novel coming out was, I would go to the bookstore every weekend looking for a new one, and back then you didn't know when a novel was going to come out. So you just had to go every single weekend looking and hoping and hoping. And it's like, and then to see, Dayworld on the shelf, or, Gods of Riverworld, or Red Ark's Rage, or, a big one for me was Escape from Loki, his Doc Savage, Doc Savage novel.
Yes.
That was a huge thing for me. If I had to trace back, when I started thinking seriously about writing, it would probably be around when early 90s when Escape from Loki came out.
Mm. Oh, boy. I remember that. And Bill had been planning that for a while because it was almost 20 years, Because he had talked about trying to get permission to do that, and he had already started laying the groundwork in the biography. And that was like 1971 or 72.
Yep.
So by the time he got it, it was almost 20 years out.
Yep.
But he was very lucky. There were two things that I know he wanted to do for certain with his life. He wanted to do an original Tarzan story, and he wanted to do an original authorized Doc Savage story, and by God, he was able to do it.
Yep. And
put a couple of really good ones in, too.
Yeah, and also an Oz story was another one of his
Oz story, that's right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Barnstormer and Oz.
Yeah.
I got all three of them myself. Yeah. Now, one thing we, ought to mention about, Phil Farmer is that some of his books weren't printed in its entirety. If I remember, Michael, was it you that was telling me on The Time's Last Gift, there's like two different versions?
Well, the original first printing of it is shorter. Right. He added a prologue, and Chris could actually probably answer this question better than I, but he added a prologue to later printings that made it a little clearer just who exactly the protagonist of the novel was. I actually sent a copy of that book to a friend of mine who's a minister, and I sent him, not even thinking or remembering this, I sent him the original first printing. And afterwards, I mentioned, yeah, could you believe that was so-and-so? And he said, that freaking guy was, I don't know, should I say
him.
It? Or
well, just him.
Yeah.
I've heard a theory that Grabardson is Tarzan, but it's not, I've never seen anyone prove it.
There you go. And so, yeah, just this guy who's a friend of mine who's a minister to say on the phone, that freaking guy was Tarzan? It's just too funny.
Yeah. Well, I kind of knew when I read it, but that's because it came out, everything kind of fit in place with if you knew a little Walt Newton in the background, and you were familiar with some of the other things Phil had written, it all kind of gelled together. But what an imagination, what a fascinating idea and test and getting it all out.
While on the subject of Time's Last Gift, I just want to mention that there's a new edition, very timely, coming out around the same time as the Gods of Opar omnibus. Titan Books is putting out Time's Last Gift. It's coming out in early June, I believe. And it will have the full version of it with the... I want to correct you, Mike. It's an epilogue, not a prologue.
My bad.
And the full version of the novel will be published. There's also some extra material in that edition. I actually wrote the afterword to it. It's called Grabardson and the Prehistoric Wold Newton Family. And I had access to some rare reference material when I was writing my afterword. There's a Professor George Edward Challenger's rare monograph the Sahindar cult and pre-Diluvian Kokarsa. And I was able to quote from that in my afterword. And also, Sir General, Sir William Clayton, General Sir William Clayton's, now hard to find travelogue, Gold and a Lost Love in Africa. And these are books that were referred to in other farmer books. The Sahindar cult in pre-Diluvian Kokarsa was referred to first in The Evil in Pemberley House by Philip Z. Farmer and Winscott Eckert. And I was able to find a copy on file at the Charles Blue Press reading room at Show Me University. So that's a special treat for the fans, I think.
Oh, very good.
And then also, there's more bonus material. I have a printout here because I've been going over the proofs lately. We have an afterword, another afterword. Gravardsson Through the Ages, A Chronology of Major Events Pertinent to Time's Last Gift by Winscott Eckert and Dennis E. Power. So it's a Wald Newton timeline, basically. These books being put out by Titan Books, they're actually doing a Wald Newton series, which has never, ever been done before with Philip Z. Farmer's work. But he very informally would refer to books, or I don't even know if he ever did refer to a Wald Newton series per se. He may have once or twice, but it was more that he wrote books that fit into the Wald Newton family or universe. And it was an informal series. So this is the first time, and it was only the hardcore fans that were able, if you really were reading everything by Farmer, were able to piece together a lot of the clues to understand that one of these works was a Wald Newton book. A lot of people, like you said, didn't understand the Wald Newton connections in Time's Last Gift, and just went over their heads like Mike's friend. And what Titan is doing is making it explicit. You know, this is a Wald Newton novel. I make the case in my afterword that it's perhaps the most important Wald Newton novel ever because of the character Gravardsson, who travels back in time and becomes Sahindar, the gray-eyed archer god of the Kokarsan civilization. And since Gravardsson, we know, was a member of the Wald Newton family, that means he was exposed to the ionization from the Wald Newton meteorite that fell in 1795. He wasn't exposed to it, but he was descended from folks who were exposed to it.
And plus, he was able to even create new ones, you know, back in the past.
Right, exactly. So he carried his genes back in time and spawned a new Wald Newton family in prehistory. And so the characters Hadon and Kwasin are both descended ultimately from Sahindar. And they carry the Wald Newton genes as well.
Mm.
So it's an endless concept.
Right. Well, now it's infusing the heroes throughout all of human history, not just the more recent ones since 1795.
Right. It goes all the way back to about what is it, 14,000 BC? I always mix up the BC and the...
Let's see.
It's about 12,000 BC, but that's 14,000 years ago.
14,000 years ago, yeah.
They have a major advance in 12,000
BC. My degree in anthropology just fell out of my head, so...
this is very, very good news. No, I think the Wald Newton series, the whole Wald Newton concept has been very popular with a lot of fans, even folks, outside of the hardcore, Phil Farmer crowd like us, they have been familiar with it. And if you talk to Wynn and all that, there's lots of evidence of people pulling the Wald Newton thing in, to other storylines. So, this is wonderful news, and, More and more information about the Sahindar cult and its influence on world history. This is going to be very interesting. More things to look at. We have several books that are going to be published in the next year in the Titan Book Series. They've announced now that A Feast Unknown is also going to be published.
With some special bonus material, I hear.
Yes, indeed. We're going to have, I actually was asked to do an afterword on that. They're going to print mine after Ted Sturgeon's afterword that was with the original edition, because I disagree with Ted on a couple of things. And I think I make the case for it. But that's going to be there. Also, The Lord of the Trees is going to be published too. And the other log of Phileas Fogg, which has not been in print for quite some time now, that's going to be coming back into print. This is a good time.
Yes, and each of these has bonus material in it, which makes it, collectors need to go out there and get these, even if they have the originals, paperback editions or what have you. You know, these are ones that you're going to want to have. Titan also does an amazing job with their production. Just the quality of the books, they have a very striking look to them. I've been able to review for the one that I wrote the afterword to, Time's Last Gift, the full wrap cover. And, they're very, very nice. They say Wold Newton right on the spine and right on the cover. I think people are going to really like these books.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
They're classic books, that anybody who's interested in the adventure fiction in general and the Wold Newton universe in particular, you really want to get a hold of these, because there's going to be a lot of good information and new information that's going to be given to help draw in all these bits and pieces together.
Yes.
The big picture. And as you said, it's critically important. Time's Last Gift is probably the most critically important of them all. In just bringing the whole Wold Newton series full circle.
Indeed.
In fact, the very initials of the story, TLG, how do I put that? It's Tarzan, Lord Greystoke.
That's what some people have speculated, although Phil denied it.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
He's got a nice thing.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things. It's probably a little giveaway, but again, that was a great story. In fact, I was surprised at the very end when all of the things started to pull together and I realized who he was. Well, when is the Gods of Opar omnibus? When is that going to be available now? From your opinion,
the street date. Is, I believe, April 30th. I think it's probably going to come out a little bit after that. I haven't heard yet back from the publisher on whether it's gone out to the printer yet or not. I know it had been lined up behind a couple books. Subterranean has a slew of books that they put out, and sometimes they get juggled around in the production schedule by a month or so. So it's coming out in a month or two, I should say.
Very good. Yeah. Well, I know I've got myself down for one of the special editions, and I just couldn't pass that up. Mm.
And, me too.
Yeah, I'm,
me
I'm
too.
Looking forward to it. Yeah,
I will try too myself.
Mm-hmm. So that's very good, and that's going to be the omnibus is entitled The Gods of Opar, but it's going to have the three stories: Haddon of Ancient Opar, Flight to Opar, and the Song of Kwasin, a complete and unabridged.
That is true.
Very good. And now we know we have something else to look forward to coming out from Meteor House. We're going to have another story in this same universe. What was the title again?
Exiles of Ko. Ko is being the mother goddess. Is very important to their culture, hence the name Ko Karsa for their culture. which means the tree on the hill of Ko.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Very good. So this is going to be a bumper year. I think for Phil Farmer fans and for Will Newton fans, we're going to be seeing an awful lot of good material coming out, and most certainly, the Gods of Gopar. This is the first time actually that, any of the, Ko Carson's novels is going to be in hardcover, isn't it?
It is, yes. So I would encourage you to go out there and get them if you're a Farmer collector, because I have no idea. My impression is that they're selling pretty well. They could sell out. I know Subterranean sells out of their Farmer books on publication sometimes. So just to be safe, if you really want to read this story, you should probably go out and get it.
Yeah.
Pre-order it. It's available on Amazon and also subterraneanpress.com.
I think that the special edition, the limited edition, is that only through Subterranean?
That is only through Subterranean, yes.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, when, after we've completed the show today, please make sure that you send us any links. We should get some links in there too for the, Ko Carson site that's on the PJ Farmer site. That's got a lot of, bonus material in it as well.
Yeah, I should mention that site actually. Mike and I put a lot of hard work into building a site dedicated to the overall culture from Gods of Opar, a site dedicated to Ko Carsa, the civilization of Ko Carsa. And it has on there, let me pull it up here so I can rattle it off. It has an introduction to Ko Carsa to give you a quick summary of what this series is based on. Has links to all the stories and where you can get them. It has a Ko Carson primer, which is a list of all the different world building terminology and Ko Carson words and things like that. And it has the chronology of Ko Carsa by Philip as a Farmer. Right on there, right on the website, so you can see the whole span of the Ko Carson civilization from 12,000 BC all the way to 10,000 BC. And then this one, the next thing, is really cool, I think, but I'm into languages and things like that. We have the Ko Carson syllabary and the actual glyphs, the hieroglyphs that they used back in ancient Ko Carsa. That Phil obviously found through some source, and brought, and, they were in his notes. So we have put them online. So you can now write in ancient Ko Carson if you would like to.
Yeah.
And then we have a page that has all the maps. We have the new maps that were drawn by the artist, Charles Berlin. He did a fantastic job, rendering the new maps, including a map of Deep Base, which is, Kwasin's home city. That's a new map for the series. And then we have the original maps as hand-drawn by Philip as a Farmer himself, if you want to see that. That stuff always fascinates me to look back at the author's original drawings and things like that. You know, it's the world-building really is I can only describe it as Tolkien-esque.
Yes.
in its level of detail. And I encourage you to follow the link here on the podcast to the Lost Ko Carsa website and take a look around, spend a few minutes looking at it. It's pretty cool stuff.
Mm-hmm. There's a nice glossary there too, which will help you when you're reading the stories. In case, gee, what does that word mean again? You can go back and it has the information right there, without spoilage.
Yep. And this is, you know, extra material that was not able, because originally I was hoping it was going to make it into the bonus chapbook, but there was only so many pages that we could fit in there, and we crammed it that as full as we could. And then we had leftover material, and I just wanted it to get out there. So we got permission from the Farmer estate to put it up for everybody to see. So... I'm hoping that, you know, there may be additional information that we put on there. The site could grow organically over the years. I'm envisioning it kind of as the hub of everything CoCarsa related. So keep checking it out.
Very good. Well, I think we're coming on to the end of the show. So as always, we have our patented shameless plugs section in case there's anything else that you had wanted to talk about that had not come up in the course of the interview. Can you think of any other announcements you wanted to make? Other books, for example, coming out from Meteor Press?
Well, we should have in time for PharmaCon this summer, The Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer 3. And I'm really excited about this book. Of course, I was excited about the first two, but this one has really come together with a theme, and there's a lot of pieces in the book that go hand in hand and support each other. And not unlike what Phil did with the Opar novels, there are just wheels within wheels and levels below levels of just intrigue and tricksterism. Layers of hoaxes within hoaxes of things that he did that we're kind of bringing all together. You know, he did over the course of his career, and we're bringing it all together in one place. So you can really see just, you know, how much of a trickster he was. I also like to mention PharmaCon. I hope you'll be there this year again, Art.
Yep, planning to be there.
For those who don't know, the bonus material in A Feast Unknown by Art Zippo was actually a speech he gave, very fascinating speech he gave at PharmaCon last year. So that's just some of the programming that we have. And, you know, the best part of PharmaCon is just sitting around for hours on end talking with people like Chris and Art and Wynn Eckert and all these people who know so much about pharma that I have a hard time keeping up with them. So, yeah, PharmaCon, you can find out information about it on pjpharma.com. It'll be in August in Columbus, Ohio. It's held in conjunction with Pulpfest, which in itself is, you know, a fabulous event. I'm looking forward to going to it just for the shopping.
Oh, yeah.
I have one question for Michael there. Now, that magazine that you had put out, was it about 12 issues?
The PharmaFile.
Yeah, the PharmaFile. Now, is there any chance that they might be reprinted as like a, you know, one big collection, or for anybody who might miss some of them?
Yeah, you know, I actually got an email about that the other day because somebody wanted some of the issues that are out of print, and we haven't really explored that, but it's certainly a possibility. The problem there is, one of the problems is that with PharmaFile, everybody who wrote for PharmaFile, wrote articles for us, did so for free. They basically did it as a thank you to Phil. And if we were to actually put it in a book and publish it, and, you know, that we'd have to turn around and look at, you know, paying people for that. So, you know, maybe we'll just print all the stuff that Phil wrote. Maybe we'll try to print everything. Maybe we'll do a best of kind of thing. And it's just going back and getting permission from that many people. Would be a big job.
Like I said, I was lucky enough to get the first one, and it, you know, I always kind of wish I could get the rest. Yeah.
Well, you can still get most of them. I think we've sold out of 4 or 5, maybe 6 of the 15.
If you're looking for most of the stories that were published in PharmaFile that were by Phil, they were collected in a volume that I edited for Subterranean Press called Up from the Bottomless Pit and Other Stories. Now, that was a limited edition and originally sold for like $125. I think you can still find copies online at various. It's out of print, but there are certain places that are still selling it online. You're probably going to pay a couple $100 for it, mm-hmm. but you know. That's a lot of issues of PharmaFile you'd have to buy too. So,
oh yeah,
right. That book actually sold out upon publication, as I recall.
Yeah.
Which I think that was the second one of Farmer's books to do that, Subterranean Press. So, as Chris said, don't figure, oh, maybe someone will buy me Gods of Opar for Christmas. You need to go ahead and order that book now while you still can.
Right. Absolutely. All righty. Go ahead.
I was about to say, the cheapest copy of Up from the Bottomless Pit and other stories I see online right now is actually for sale from the estate. I guess I need to jack the price up. It's $160. And there are four copies. Well, I also have a $200 one. But there are other copies from other people that are going for $165, and then someone has a whole set of the Subterranean Press books. But, yeah, they are very hard to find.
Well, if anybody's interested, I do have a birthday coming up in about a month.
We'll keep it in mind.
Do we still have a time for a little plug from me?
Sure, gotcha. Go for it.
Just a couple things very briefly. One of my last stories published was in a book called The Avenger, The Justice Inc. Files, a story called Devil's Dark Harvest. The Avenger, of course, is a member of the Wold Newton family, very, very close on the family tree to Farmer's character Kickaha from the World of Tears series. So don't be surprised if you don't see allusions to that in my story. So that's available right now from Moonstone Books. And I wanted to plug something that's not mine, but the Sherlock Holmes crossover casebook, which I just picked up. I was at NorwestCon promoting Gods of Opar this past weekend, and I found it in the dealer's room, and it looks fantastic. And it's got a very relevant story, The Adventure of the Fallen Stone, by John H. Watson, M.D., as edited by Wynn Scott Eckert. And it is very crucial to the whole Wold Newton mythos and the origins of the Wold Newton universe and family. So I would highly recommend that. I've read Wynn's story in manuscript form, so I can vouch for that. And the rest of it looks fantastic, too. So that's also from Moonstone Books, edited by the late, great Howard Hopkins.
Yes, yes. Who passed away a couple of months ago. That was a long time in coming. They were batting that around for a while, and Amazon actually dropped my order. I had to go over to Barnes & Noble to reorder it again, and now it's finally out. Everybody's got it available.
Yeah.
But it's a great collection.
Sherlock Holmes, The Crossovers Casebook.
Right. Okay, alrighty, well, I guess that kind of brings us to the end of another show. We want to thank both, Chris Carey and, Mike Croteau for coming on board and to talking with us about The Song of Kwasin, the new novel in the Cole Carson series. And as we said earlier, it is being published as a part of an omnibus volume by Subterranean Press called The Gods of Opar. This volume is available in a regular edition and in a limited edition. The limited edition has an extra chapbook with a lot of extra material relating to Cole Carson. It's available for order at the Subterranean website. Is it available for order up at Amazon and Barnes & Noble as well right now?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it's ready. And it should be coming out within the next few weeks. So by all means, you know, go out there and get it. I think you'll really enjoy it. If you haven't read the Cole Carson novels, you're in for a treat. There are great series that Phil had originated back in the 1970s and which has been ably added to by our friend Chris. So we want to thank you guys for coming on and for giving us the exclusive too about the new Carson book coming out from Meteor Press. We'll be looking for that this time in August of this year. So I guess that brings us to the end of another show. This is Art Sippo.
And Rick Croxton.
And, of course, Mike and Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You are now leaving the book cave. Have a pleasant evening.
Bye for now.